I've enjoyed singing these songs that we've just sung. Appreciate Stephen's leading of those songs. I've come to appreciate him very much for the way in which he helps us to understand the importance of that part of our worship. I don't know of anybody who selects songs any more thoughtfully for us to sing than Stephen does, or who does a better job of helping us to understand the thoughts of the songs that we sing. And a generation or two ago, preachers that would hold a lot of gospel meetings very often would take their song leader with them. If I could, I'd take Stephen with me. But you'd probably have something to say about that. Keep your hands off of Stephen, Brother Henry. But good to be with him and with all of you. I look forward to this week of what at the end of it will seem like a very brief time that we were together. But I look forward to getting to know you a little bit more fully. I've known of you for a long time. I've known various members of the Smeltzer family for many, many years, and have known others of you in various ways. And so I will cherish these few days that we will have together, and hope that in all that we do, that we can grow stronger in our faith in the act of worshiping our God together. And so thankful for the opportunity that we'll have this week. As Stephen has said, we're going to be talking about priorities tonight, and that's a very important subject. As I think it was Stephen Covey many years ago used to say, the main thing is to keep the main thing the main thing. But that's not easy to do, is it? We can let our priorities become disordered and start paying major attention to minor things. And in regard to the Lord, all the more important for us to keep our priorities where they need to be. But a part of the difficulty of that is being honest enough to see when our priorities are not what they ought to be. There's a story that Jesus told in the 19th chapter of Matthew. If you would turn to Matthew 19, I want us to read several verses beginning at verse 16. Matthew 19, verse 16. Behold, a man came up to him saying, "Teacher, what good deed must I do to have eternal life?" And he said to him, "Why do you ask me about what is good? There is only one who is good. If you would enter life, keep the commandments." He said to him, "Which ones?" And Jesus said, "You shall not murder, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not steal, you shall not bear false witness, honor your father and mother, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself." The young man said to him, "All these I have kept. What do I still lack?" Jesus said to him, "If you would be perfect, go sell what you possess and give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven, and come follow me." But then the very sad statement in verse 22, that when the young man heard this, he went away sorrowful, for he had great possessions. I don't have any doubt but if you would ask this young man what is most important to you, he would have said God is the most important thing. But it is obvious, based upon a decision that he made here, that there was something else more important to him than God. So whatever his words might have indicated, his deeds indicated that there was something else, his possessions, that even had a greater priority. There was a writer many years ago, I forget whether she was a psychologist, it seems to me, who wrote a book on the difference between what she called espoused values and values in action. And the distinction that she had in mind there was the distinction between what we say is most important and what, based upon our real world actions, obviously is the most important thing. I expect most of us in the room tonight, if somebody would ask us, "Is the Lord the most important thing to you?" we would say yes. And we intend for that to be true. That's our ideals. That's a part of our principles. We understand that things are what they ought to be. That would be the correct answer. But if we're not quite careful in this world of multiple priorities, where so many things clamor for our attention, our priorities can become disordered. And being honest enough to face that truth is sometimes not easy. So what I want us to do tonight is just ask ourselves some very practical questions. that would help us see more honestly what our real priorities, whatever we may say about that, what would these questions indicate about what is really most important to us? And the first of these questions is simply, what would other people say our priorities are? And by others, I mean people who know us, especially those who know us well. Others might not know you as well as you know yourself, and nobody else who knows you as well as the Lord does. So while other people might have only limited information to deal with about us, very often other people are more objective about what they do know about us than we are objective about ourselves. What about your next door neighbors? If you know your next door neighbors, I'm afraid in our society very often we're strangers even to the people who live in close proximity to us. But your neighbors, maybe the people that you work with on your job, the people who have some kind of regular contact with you, if I would go and ask them, what's the most important thing to this person? What would they say? Well, I would hope that they would say, based even on their limited information about you, that God is the most important thing in that person's life. But unfortunately, the people that we work with and our neighbors and especially our children, and of all the people who know you, your children probably know you better than anybody else. They see you 24/7. They see you in your off moments. They see you not just when you're putting your best self forward. They see you as you really are. What would your children be able to tell me if I could have a private, confidential conversation with them and ask them about their parents? What would they say is the most important thing to you? They could probably tell me that you have tried to teach them that the Lord is the most important thing in life, and they would probably report that sometimes they see you doing things that relate to the Lord, but they might also, because they know you so well and they see you around the clock, they may have some practical information that would indicate that when all is said and done, the Lord may not be quite as important to you as you have tried to lead them to believe. And I, you know, that's a hard thing to say. And all of us as parents and spouses and coworkers and neighbors, all of the relationships that we have, it might be painful to acknowledge what somebody else would say based upon what they see us doing in the real world from day to day, what they would say is most important to us. That's an honest question to answer. Now, that won't always give you all the information you need. Sometimes people can draw false conclusions. Sometimes if that person only sees you in a very narrow slice of your life, that wouldn't give them all the information that they need to tell what is truly the most important to you. They'd need to see a wider selection of your activities. But it is helpful, I think, sometimes for us to ask that question and answer it honestly. Those who know me well, those who know me the best, what do they know? What do they see is the most important thing to me? A similar question is this one. What do we think about? I've got some spacing problems there. Just ignore that. What do we think about when we could be thinking about anything we want to think about? When your mind is just kind of idling, and there's no task at hand at that moment that requires you to be focusing on anything in particular, your mind is free just to roam where it will and think about what it wants to think about. What do you think about in those moments? What is your mind drawn to? Obviously, all of us would want to be like the person in Psalm 1 who delights in the law of the Lord, and in his word he meditates day and night. I don't know about you, but that statement to me describes a person who doesn't have to be required to think about God. They enjoy thinking about God, and they think about God a lot when they could be thinking about other things, simply because they find that a delightful thing to do. It's very important to them, and so they find their minds being drawn to that, just like a strong magnet. That's where their thoughts go. What happens in your mind when your mind is in neutral says a lot about you. Now, you may think you don't have very much time like that. Not very many moments in an average day when you don't have to be thinking about some specific thing or another. But all of us have a few moments now and then. I find myself having a lot of that time because of the amount of time I spend on the road traveling. I really enjoy those miles. Somebody asked me just the other day if I don't ever get tired of driving, why don't you fly anymore? Well, I used to fly more than I do, but I enjoy that time because when you're sitting there behind the wheel, you can think about things that you don't have much time to think about otherwise, and I find that to be very enjoyable. But if I would look very honestly, Gary, what do you think about when you're just driving down the road? What would that say about what is really the most important to me? Someone once said, what the heart likes best, the mind studies the most. You will think about that which you enjoy thinking about. And if that's the Lord, if it's true when somebody asks you, is the Lord the most important, and you say yes, if that really is true, that's going to be indicated by how much you find yourself thinking about God when you could be thinking about anything. But your mind is just naturally drawn to that which is truly the most delightful to you. The person who finds that he only meditates on God when he has to be doing that, it's time for his daily Bible reading, or it's time to have a devotion with the family, or we're at Bible study, or we're at worship, so now we're thinking about God. The person who finds that those are the only times that he thinks about God is probably lying if he says the spiritual life is his overriding concern. If it were, he would find himself thinking about God on times when it's not compulsory, times when his mind is just has the freedom to think about whatever it finds delightful. It scares me a little bit sometimes when I'm driving down the road to catch myself thinking about so many things other than God. I do think about God a good deal during those private times, but I'm probably like you. Our minds are just pulled in so many different directions now. There's so many concerns competing for our attention. Times I just have to say to myself, mind, settle down. Just be still and think about God. Let him be as important to you as you preach to people that he ought to be. So what do we think about? What do you think about when you could be thinking about anything else? You know, if you are friends with me on Facebook, you probably know that I occasionally post something about food or barbecue, just once in a while. And somebody recently concluded that that's all I ever think about. Well, that's all they ever hear of me on Facebook, and really the truth of that is that it just has happened that that's the only thing I talk about on Facebook anymore, because that's the only thing you can talk about without giving people an occasion to make obnoxious comments. And so it's the most harmless topic that I've found that you can talk about on Facebook. But I hope you wouldn't conclude from what I talk about on Facebook that those are the only things that are important to me. That's a narrow slice of my life. But I need to be honest enough when I don't have to be thinking about anything in particular to tell myself the truth. Is the Lord as important as he ought to be to you? Do you enjoy thinking about him when you could be thinking about other things? Another question is, and this kind of flows naturally out of the second one, what do we talk about when we could be talking about anything we want to? Our conversations arise out of the things that are on our minds, don't they? Something's important to somebody, it's going to show up in their conversation. And if we have to admit that we rarely talk about the Lord, except in connection with church services and those times when it has to be talked about, that ought to tell us something. You know, the Lord said in Matthew chapter 12 that things flow from what is in our heart. You know, there's a sense in which what we say and do, that's just kind of the overflow from what's in our hearts. And so if a person has an evil heart, that's going to show up outwardly. If a person has a good heart, that's going to show up as well. Matthew 12, verse 34. You brood of vipers, how can you speak good when you are evil? For out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. The good person out of his good treasure brings forth good, and the evil person out of his evil treasure brings forth evil. To me, it's an encouraging sign that these days I seem to hear more conversations about spiritual matters than I used to hear outside the assembly. I think that's a good indication. Maybe years before, those things were on our minds. We just weren't talking about them. Overall, it is true that what we talk about is eventually going to be that which we're thinking about and that which is truly important to us. In the part of the country where I live, sports very important. This time of year, football is a very, very important topic of conversation. It would be humorous if sometimes it weren't actually sad to hear how much we talk about football in the South. Well, why do we do that? Well, because that's important to us. That's why it shows up that often in conversation. We can disguise that any way we want to. We can try to reason our way around it. But the reason we talk about it that much is that it's that important to us. Where is the Lord in all of that? I was in a meeting several years ago in a place where I had never been before. I didn't know any of the people at all before I got there. Under those circumstances, as the week unfolds, you begin to draw some conclusions about them, and they begin to draw some conclusions about you as well. I don't know how well you can get to know somebody in a week in a gospel meeting, but you can at least form some tentative conclusions. As I left that meeting, was driving back home, it occurred to me that I had been in the homes of each of the three elders. In most of those occasions, all of the other elders and their wives were there present, along with the gospel preacher and his family. I didn't recall driving back home in any of those settings, in those homes, those kind of social interactions, that anything spiritual had come up in the conversation. I couldn't recall for the entire week in any of the homes that I'd been in, at the dinner table when we could be talking about anything we want to, I couldn't remember in that meeting anything spiritual having come up just spontaneously because somebody wanted to talk about those things. Well, there might have been many reasons for that. That might have been an exceptional sample and might not have fairly indicated what's really important to those people, but that's some kind of an indication, isn't it? What do we talk about? That will tell us something about our priorities. Now, think about this one. How do we spend our discretionary time? And you might well say, what is that, Brother Henry? If you're talking about free time there that doesn't have to be spent on anything else, who has any of that anymore? And I know there's precious little discretionary time because there's precious little discretionary anything anymore. Hardly any of us have as much spare time as we'd like, but all of us have a few minutes once in a while where we could be doing anything we want to. How we spend that says a lot about our true priorities. I know a family who have a number of kids, I think 6 or 7 kids, and they're not able to do this anymore because all the older kids are growing up and away from home, so they have kids of their own. But in the younger years, there was a particular event in another state that was kind of a gospel meeting, but not really a gospel meeting, but sort of a lecture program that they had just found very profitable to go to as a family. And they had made a decision as a family to go to that every year. And the kids were in favor of that as well. As a family, they just saw that as something that they profited from. They enjoyed doing it. They looked forward to it every year. And this is a family of modest means financially, and they had to save up through the year to be able to go to that event every year. I stayed in their home one time, and we were talking about that, and the dad and the mom, they say the kids work through the year doing odd jobs to help save up the money so that we can make this trip every summer. Well, they weren't bragging about that. It just had kind of come up in a roundabout way, and so it struck my curiosity, and I was asking them some questions about how they went in their family. Did they have to do that? No. It was kind of their family vacation every year to go to this event that had some spiritual benefit to it. Could have done other things with that time and with that money as well. If they had tried to tell me, Gary, spiritual priorities are the number one thing in our life, I would tend to believe it in regard to that family because I could see it in the way they use their discretionary time. When they choose to do with their spare time something that relates to the Lord rather than the world, that gives a little bit of credence, doesn't it, to their claim that the Lord is very important to them. And I cite them just as an example. How does that look in your life? How do you spend your discretionary time? It's interesting to me that we're all busy these days. Most families have to have more than one wage earner to even to subsist. So we're all very busy making a living. And I constantly hear people complaining about the fact that they just don't believe they have enough time, don't have as much time as they wish they had to engage in the Lord's work. Well, that's true. But if that is true, if we wish that we could be spending more time in the Lord's work, but we can't because of all these work commitments, it looks like the minute we retired and had more time on our hands, that we would immediately throw ourselves more fully into the Lord's work. But what very often happens? We spend even less time in retirement than we did in our working years in the Lord's work because we see that as time that we have finally earned where we can enjoy life a little bit. And so we vacation and we do all of these things. Well, all those previous years we said we wish we could do more of the Lord's work, but we can't because of these commitments. Now we have some time that we could do with anything we want to. What do we do with it? I think our use of time is some kind of fair indication of whether we're telling the truth when we say we love the Lord more than anything else in the world. John said in 1 John chapter 3 and verse 18 that we need to be careful not to love the world. Little children, that's another verse we're going to mention in a minute. 1 John 3, verse 18 is where he says, let us not love in word or in talk, but in deed and in truth. Let's just don't say that we love the Lord. Let's back that up with action. Let's do with our time what a person would do if he really did love the Lord with all of his heart. But you would also then have to add the question, what do we do with our discretionary money? And there may be even less of that, but there is discretionary time, I understand, that takes almost every penny we can scrape together to buy the essentials, it seems. But all of us have a little discretionary money, don't we? What do we do with it? Well, I can't help but think of the example of the Corinthians in 2 Corinthians chapter 8, when Paul commended the Macedonian Christians to those in Corinth for their example of wanting to help out in this contribution that was being made for the needy Christians back down in Judea. Apparently the brethren in Macedonia were poor themselves. I may be misunderstanding Paul here, but I seem to hear him saying that the Macedonians were really poor themselves. They didn't, you could have said, you don't really need to take part in this. Let other people take care of this who have more to do with. But they insisted that they wanted to help. They begged for the privilege of being a part of this. 2 Corinthians 8, verse 1, we want you to know, brothers, about the grace of God that has been given among the churches of Macedonia. For in a severe test of affliction, their abundance of joy and their extreme poverty have overflowed in a wealth of generosity on their part. For they gave according to their means, as I can testify, and beyond their means. Of their own accord, begging us earnestly for the favor of taking part in the relief of the saints. And this not as we expected, but they gave themselves first to the Lord and then by the will of God to us. What a wonderful thing for Paul to be able to say about those Macedonians that they wanted to take part in this help for brethren that I guess thought they're even needier than we are. So we want to help them. and wouldn't take no for an answer from Paul, that would tend to give a little bit of weight to their claim that the Lord was really important to them, because they were showing that in the way they used even a very limited amount of money. I was talking to somebody just the other day about the uniqueness of my financial support in the Lord's work. I'm not a real gospel preacher. I don't work on a full-time basis with a local congregation. I'm a member of the Woodland Hills congregation in Nashville, Tennessee, and they help a little bit with my financial support, but almost all of my support is from congregations in various places who want to help me be free to go wherever I need to go to do anything that anybody thinks I can help with in the Lord's work. I receive a significant portion of my support from individuals who want to help me be able to do that. Some of those in very, very small quantities. There is a widow who sends me $10 a month that she can't afford to send. I tried to say, "Sister, I don't want to take the widow's two mites. you need it more than I do." She said, "Gary, the widow was willing to give Elijah everything she had and was blessed for it. Don't deny me the privilege of helping you." Well, she doesn't have to do that. And none of the brethren who support me have to do that. It is strictly voluntary. But as I said to this brother that I was talking with the other day about this, it has imparted a whole different level of seriousness and accountability on my part. I'll guarantee you, when I know that my time in the Lord's work is being paid for by a widow sending $10 a month that they can't afford to send, I better be very careful how I spend that time. Folks are willing to do something like that, and she's not unique, and many other people would be willing to sacrifice just as greatly to help me in any need in the Lord's work. That says far more than words about what's important to people. That's real world evidence that the Lord is number one. And anything that will help his work, they want to spend some of their discretionary money, and maybe even some that's not discretionary, on things that relate to spiritual matters and not just temporal concerns. I hesitate to use this example because I'm sort of in the publishing business. I write, but I publish my own books. And so I don't, in what I'm about to say, I don't want you to think I'm trying to sell books. But occasionally I will recommend some book that would be a good study tool to somebody in their Bible study. And, books are expensive nowadays. You don't have to buy much of a book for it to be $30. And occasionally I recommend some study tool, not one of my own books, but, something, a book on Bible history and geography or something like that that could help somebody in their Bible study at home. And they say, I could never afford that. That's a lot of money. Well, then they'll turn right around and spend far more than that on Friday night taking the family out to eat and maybe going to a movie. Where are our priorities here? We claim we can't afford to spend something that relates to our spiritual lives, and then we will spend far more of that on something that's purely for entertainment or relaxation. Nothing inherently wrong with those expenditures, but a limited amount of money, we say something about our priorities, about how we allocate limited resources. Are we going to put it here? We're going to put it there. Most of us as Americans spend huge amounts of money on recreational activities. We just can't deny that. If you don't, then you are certainly an exception to the average American life. Sporting events and recreational activities of all different kinds, decorative home furnishings for our houses, and things that are just in the realm of want to and not have to. But then we'll turn right around and say, "I couldn't afford it," when somebody suggests even a much smaller expenditure that has to do with spiritual priorities. Who are we fooling If that's the way we spend our money, who are we fooling when we say, the Lord is the most important thing in my life? I would give my life for the Lord. But you won't even spend a little bit of your discretionary money. Something's wrong with that picture. And I struggle with that just as much as you do. We're all caught in this same web of the affluent culture in which we live. And we all struggle to make, to prioritize our decisions about the use of both time and money. Neither one of those unlimited resources. The time is more limited than the money is. None of us ever get any more than 24 hours a day, so that's very limited. But not even the money that we might make in a lifetime is infinite. It's only going to be a certain amount of that. So the question is, where do we put these things? Sometimes our values and our priorities will be illustrated by putting it in regard to things that have to do with heaven and not just things that have to do with this earth. But the final question I want to ask you is this one. Whatever else you would say about what's important to you, I'm interested in what, in your schedule book, what gives when there's a conflict of priorities about the use of your time. I don't know if you use a literal schedule book or not, or if you keep that on your phone or your iPad. But let's say you've got a schedule book, and here's a slot some evening of the week, 3 weeks from now. And there are two different things wanting to occupy that same slot. One of them is a spiritual activity, and another one is just some secular activity. Not anything wrong, but just something of this world rather than eternal life. Both of these activities, important to us, both we would desire, they're good. Which one is going to give? Which one is going to take back seat? You've got a choice to make about... both of them can't occupy that same time slot. So a choice is going to have to be made, which is going to yield to which. Let me tell you, we make those decisions all of the time. You know it and I know it. There's not near enough room in that schedule book for us to write in everything that we want to do. And just as is true with money, you don't have an unlimited amount of money. You can't have everything you want. Some choices have to be made. You can't do everything you want. Some choices have to be made. Some things have to be let go of. I don't know of anything that will tell me any more about your real priorities than what gives when there's a schedule conflict. What has to yield? The spiritual activity or the temporal activity? I'm afraid in all too many cases, the spiritual activity usually yields to the temporal activity because we say, I have to do that. Well, you don't have to do anything. You do what you do because of what you believe is important. And what yields, what has to make some sacrifice, that will tell us perhaps more than anything else about what is really and truly the most important thing in your life. I wish we could get more comfortable with the concept of sacrifice. That yes, there might be something else this week that calls for your attention rather than being here for the services of the church. And not doing that may cost you dearly. Something that relates to your job. Telling your boss you can't be there, you've got another priority that outranks that. Maybe some serious implication with regard to your job. Are we comfortable using the word sacrifice and understanding that prioritizing things, either in the Lord's direction or in the direction of temporal activities, that there can be sacrifice on both sides? Which sacrifice you're willing to make says a lot about your true priority. As I was looking over these notes this afternoon, I was thinking about an incident several years ago that happened with regard to my youngest son, Grant, who's an avid golfer. And to say that he's an avid golfer is quite an understatement. He loves golf. Doesn't love it quite so much now at 30 as he used to like it, particularly when he was in high school. He He's a very good golfer, very, very gifted golfer. And his sophomore year in high school, I didn't know this until after it had happened. His sophomore year in high school, he had one more golf tournament that he would have had to have played in order to get his letter in golf that year. But that tournament was on a Wednesday afternoon. And when they got to the golf course, and he was happened to be the last to tee off that afternoon, he stepped up to the tee box and looked at his watch. It was obvious to him he was not going to be able to play that round of golf and get to Wednesday night Bible study. And he turned to his coach and said, "I can't play today, coach." "Why?" "Well, I need to be at Bible study tonight." "Is there something special going on tonight?" "No, it's just Bible study." And as respectfully as he could, he declined to play that afternoon. It cost him his letter and cost his team that tournament. Sacrifice. And to know how much of a sacrifice it was, you didn't know how much Grant wanted that letter that year. But he let go of that for something more important to him. I say, I didn't even know about that until his coach told me about it several months later. Well, there's a kid, even in his sophomore year in high school, that understands that life is full of choices. And it's all well and good to talk about the Lord being the number one thing in our life. But where we'll find out whether that's true or not is in the way we make our choices, particularly when two things want to occupy the same spot in your schedule book. What gives to what? What yields to what? What has to take the back seat and what gets the front seat? That's going to tell us a lot about what really and truly is our priority. In 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 10, I wish I knew more about this than I do, but it is a sad statement, isn't it? In 2 Timothy 4 and verse 10, when Paul simply says, Demas, whom Paul had expressed appreciation for and helping him in his work in Rome, here he says, Demas, in love with this present world, has deserted me and gone to Thessalonica. We don't know what it was. I would almost guarantee you that it would... whatever it was that Demas had to tend to back in Thessalonica was something extremely important. Important to him anyway. And if you'd asked Demas, he would have said, this doesn't mean that I love the Lord any less. I've just got to take care of that. But Paul summed it up very succinctly, didn't he? When he said, Demas made that choice because he loves this present world. Breaks my heart to think how many times Paul might have to say the same thing about Gary Henry. Choices that I've made, that despite my words to the contrary, would argue loud and clear that I love this present world more than I love the Lord. And let me just tell you, gospel preachers have to struggle with that just as much as anybody else does. So what are our priorities? What would the people who know you the best, particularly your children, say really makes you tick? What flips your switch? What is really important to you? They know. They could tell me. And it might differ from the answer you would give me. What do we think about? What do we talk about? How do we spend our free time? And how do we spend our free money? And when it comes to schedule conflict, how do we resolve those conflicts? You know, in Romans chapter 6 and verse 16, Paul summed it up pretty well, didn't he? When he said, the way you know who your master is by looking at who you're obeying. Romans 6 verse 16, do you not know that if you present yourselves to anyone as obedient slaves, you are the slaves of the one whom you obey? Either of sin, which leads to death, or of obedience, which leads to righteousness. No, you're saying the Lord is your master if you're obeying the devil. Your master is the one that you obey. And the thing that's most important to us is the thing that's evidenced by these tests of how we spend our time and our money in the real world. One thing is clear, I think. We live in a society where the pursuit of ever higher levels of affluence, people take it so for granted that if you're an American, that's what you do. You work as hard as you can to have an ever higher standard of living, greater and greater affluence. If you question that, somebody will question your Americanism, if not your Christianity. So we talk about the American dream. And I guess, rightly considered, there's not anything wrong with the American dream if it's kept within the bounds of the Lord's will. But listen. I can't give the first and the best of myself to what we call the American dream and then turn around and say, the Lord is my first love. You can't have two masters, Jesus said in Matthew 6 and 24. You can't go all out for one thing and then truthfully claim that something else is more important to you. The evidence is clear. So where your priorities are, there your energy and your enthusiasm will be also. That's what you'll exert energy and enthusiasm for, the things that are priorities to you. So the Lord pronounced a blessing in the Beatitudes, Matthew chapter 5 and verse 8, on the pure in heart. I believe that involves far more than just having clean hearts, though that would be the beginning point for that discussion. But the pure heart is the heart that is purely and single-mindedly focused on the Lord without competing concerns. You wouldn't feel good, would you, if your spouse came up to you tonight and said, honey, I really do love you. It's your husband. If he said, I really do love you. There's some other women that I love a little bit, but I love you the most. You wouldn't feel very good about that, would you? What you want to hear is, honey, I love you with all of my heart. You have no rivals in my heart. There is no competition. You have my heart completely. That's what the Lord wants for us, from us. And that's what he deserves to receive from us. He deserves nothing less than that. We would insult the Lord. If he is our creator, we would insult him by giving him any less than our best, than our all. We're all striving for it to be that way, aren't we? I don't get that right all the time, and you don't either. But one thing we can do as a result of a few minutes like this, where the preacher just made us think about this, we can determine to do better about it. We can make progress, we can make adjustments, and we can get it a little bit better tomorrow than we got it today. So, you will find, if you haven't already, before the week is out, that I just preach about things I need to hear. And I really need to hear this one tonight. And if you get any good out of it, then that'd just be extra. May we all love the Lord with more of our heart every day. And won't it be wonderful when the time comes for us to look upon his face and all of these conflicts and competing loyalties will have been done away with, and we'll be able to love the Lord with complete purity and receive his love without any interference, and that'll be the joy of heaven. Perfect relationship of love with the Lord that will last forever. If you're here tonight and in any way subject to the Lord's invitation, if there's some way that we could help you to do something that you know needs to be done that would put you closer to the Lord than you were when you got here, then we'd love to help you with that. That's why we're here, to help one another and encourage one another. And we sing this invitation song not just for the few that might be here who need to respond in some kind of public way. The more I think about it, the more I see the value in an invitation song as a challenge to every single one of us to ask the question as we sing, how am I going to respond to this? What am I going to do about this? And if what you can do about this is something that we can help you with, then all you need to do is just come to the front and let us know of that. If we can help you, won't you come while we stand and sing?